From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Stephen Levitt, recognized in 2003 as the country's most outstanding economist under the age of 40, stays far away from the economic policy debates in Washington. Instead, he asks questions that interest him, like what makes a perfect parent and why do drug dealers live with their moms? And then he follows the numbers. His findings are often startling. Tonight on Point, beyond ideologies of right and left, with the myth-busting economist Stephen Levitt. But first, we begin tonight with the latest on the future of the New York Stock Exchange, which agreed to a merger last week with a company that would push it toward electronic trading. It looks like it may receive another bid soon from a friend of ousted former New York Stock Exchange chairman Richard Grasso. Joining me now to talk about what this means for investors and the country is Michael Mandel, chief economist at Businessweek magazine. Michael, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, very glad to be here.
So help us wade into this. Who's bidding for whom, and what's the point? What's going on?
Well, first, what's going on is a total transformation, really, of the stock market. Up to now, we had a dominant stock market, which was the New York Stock Exchange,
yes,
and then some smaller ones. And right now, you have the New York Stock Exchange merging with an electronic exchange, Archipelago. You have NASDAQ merging with Instanet,
yes,
and that's going to lead to a duopoly. Now, what went on today is that another bid came in for New York Stock Exchange from Ken Langone, who's a billionaire, who's a friend of Richard Grasso, and who was the ousted head of the New York Stock Exchange. And if this sounds like a soap opera, it kind of is.
So of course, Richard Grasso ousted after that huge pay package. Ken Langone, a co-founder of Home Depot, deep pockets there. Does this mean that Richard Grasso, via a friend, is coming back and just buying the whole place out?
Isn't that a funny story? I don't think it's actually going to happen. This is not the normal sort of takeover bid. New York Stock Exchange is not the normal sort of company. It's owned by its members, and they're going to go for the bid that gives them the best chance of staying in business, and that's probably going to be the merger with the electronic exchange. But this could be a very fun show while it's going on.
Now, what's the significance of these mergers with electronic exchanges? Does it mean the end of the bell and the bullpen screaming and all the traders on the floor of the stock exchanges? Is that going to be history?
It's certainly going to become a lot less important. What it means is that the stock exchange, the equity markets, which are at the very heart of the U.S. financial system, are about to move from the 20th to the 21st century. And this is big news for everybody, for investors, and for anybody who really cares about where the economy is going, because all of a sudden we're moving from a system where, as you say, a lot of the trading was done on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange, to something which is electronic and very much different. And
apart from the aesthetics, not having the guys in their jackets shouting and waving their fingers, does it change the way stocks are traded? Does it change who wins and who loses?
That's a very good question. A lot of it comes on whether or not the two new entities, that is the New York Stock Exchange and the NASDAQ, plus their electronic trading partners, are they going to compete more heavily for people's business, or are they going to collude? Because if they compete, it could mean cheaper stock trades,
mm-hmm,
less fees on mutual funds. It could have a lot of beneficial effects. If they collude, it could mean that costs go up, and that would be a bad thing.
What's the timetable look like here? When are we going to see the all-new 21st century stock exchange unveiled?
Depends on how these guys fight it out. You know, you can't when you've got a soap opera going on, you don't know how long it's going to take. And it could happen very quickly. It could happen very slowly. I think this is almost inevitable. This is the New York Stock Exchange has been holding this back for a long time. Richard Grasso was holding it back for a long time. And it's going to turn out that stock trades will be executed much more quickly. And hopefully it will be beneficial to people, but we don't know yet.
Well, for everybody who gets excited by those scenes of tumult on the stock exchange floor, savor them now. We don't know how long they'll last. Michael Mandel, thanks for being with us tonight.
Oh, very glad to be here.
Michael Mandel, chief economist at Businessweek magazine and author of Rational Exuberance, Silencing the Enemies of Growth and Why the Future is Better Than You Think. He spoke with me from New York. Economist Stephen Levitt has little tolerance for conventional wisdom. Rather than look for answers in the same old places, he digs deep into the data. In his new book, Freakonomics, a rogue economist explores the hidden side of everything. He asks a broad range of questions, from how to successfully parent to why crime dropped in the 1990s, and then goes to the numbers. His answers surprise because they are often contrary to what our intuition tells us is true. Levitt's curiosity, his fresh perspective, and his ingenious analytical sleuthing have made him a standout interpreter of facts in an age of ideological pontification. Tonight on Point, myth-busting by the numbers with economist Stephen Levitt. You can join the conversation. Do you feel sometimes like a prisoner of opinion these days? Could a tough numerical analysis give us answers where politicians give us polarization? And are there truths, even maybe a third way, that ideology just can't find? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Chicago is Stephen Levitt, professor of economics at the University of Chicago. He's 2003 winner of the John Bates Clark Medal, awarded every 2 years to the nation's top economist under 40. He's co-author of the new book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. Good evening and welcome, Stephen Levitt.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that kind introduction.
Well, it's great to have you, and fun to have you, because you pull the lid off in such unexpected ways. Speaking of Freakonomics, are you a freak in your own profession here with your kind of a micro approach to going in with this tight analysis of questions about why prostitutes make more than architects and whether swimming pools are more dangerous than guns? Are you a freak?
Well, I think I'm a bit of a freak. I'm less of a freak than I would have been 20 years ago. There's been a big move in the profession of economics towards the use of data and also towards asking questions that aren't the typical interest rate, money supply questions, but rather about education, about cities, about race. And so I think most of my colleagues would call me a bit of a freak, though, still.
What drives you to come at things from this angle? Or to put it another way, along the lines of our intro, when you hear the very ideologically charged conversation that goes on in the country today, do you think it's really getting at the reality of the country today?
I think a lot of people have a lot invested in conventional wisdom, in points of view that are polarizing, and that, questions of morality are first and foremost in the way most people view many public debates. And as an economist, we tend to approach problems in a very different way, not in an immoral way, but in an amoral way. One of the things we say in the book is that economics is the way the world really works, and morality is the way we'd like the world to work. And so that's really the premise for how I start when I tackle a question.
So if conventional wisdom is so often wrong, as you write, why? On the other side, we're told by Malcolm Gladwell, hey, just blink, and you'll know what's happening. You seem to be suggesting something else.
Well, I do love the book Blink. Don't get me wrong. I think it's a fascinating book. I think that conventional wisdom is often wrong because people love to hear stories that make them feel good about the way the world works. And that's when John Kenneth Galbraith coined the term. He did it in a very pejorative way, that conventional wisdom was, what people wanted to hear rather than what would be true. Now, of course, probably 9 times out of 10, the conventional wisdom, it would be correct. But if you look hard, maybe that 1 out of 10, you can start to, look under a few stones and find that 1 out of 10.
We've got a couple of minutes before our first break here. Take us in to one or two of your stories. Where did you see some conventional wisdom that caught your eye, didn't smell right? You brought your approach, and what did you find? Give us an example.
Well, one example worth talking about maybe is the view of guns as being very, very dangerous to children relative to swimming pools.
Of course, people all standing around at cocktail parties saying, oh, I think guns are much more dangerous than swimming pools. I mean, really? Are people really asking each other, which is more dangerous, my gun or my pool?
I don't think they're asking that question, but you hear parents saying, I would never let my child play at Johnny's house because his parents have a gun.
Oh, okay. I hear that.
Really, when you look at the numbers, it's not even close that if you have a gun in the home and you have a swimming pool in the backyard, the swimming pool is about 100 times more likely to kill your child than the gun is. And I think that's something that it's a simple fact. As you can look at the data, it's there. But I don't think it's well appreciated.
That's a fairly simple one. You can look at gun ownership, pool ownership, and death rates in those households. Give us a more complex one you've taken on.
Well, a more complex one would be why crime fell in the 1990s. We had the most incredible decline in crime, unparalleled, in the 1990s. Homicide rates fell about 50% to levels we haven't seen since the early 1960s. And if you look at the newspapers and what the credit is being given to, it's things like the innovative policing strategies done in New York City and then adopted elsewhere, or maybe the robust economic growth, gun control laws, et cetera, things like that. And And my analysis suggests that that's really those aren't the answers at all, that there are two things that did matter. More police did matter, and more prisons mattered, and that's something that many people would believe. But the biggest single cause for the decline in crime, I would argue, based on the data, my joint work with John Donahue, who's now at Yale Law School, mm-hmm. was the legalization of abortion in the early 1970s.
You're saying then that these were criminals who were never born? That starts to sound controversial.
Well, it's controversial, but I think you've got to approach it with the right frame of mind, which is we're not trying to take a stand on whether abortion is good or bad. We're just making a simple observation that abortion is, that in this country, very shortly after Roe versus Wade, there were a million abortions performed every year in this country, and there were only about 3 million children born. So if you do the math, it's hard to imagine that something like the legalization of abortion wouldn't have a tremendous effect on social outcomes.
I don't want to make the wrong cause and effect. Are you saying fewer unwanted children, therefore fewer criminals?
Exactly. The theory behind it couldn't be simpler. And I think it rests on two arguments that are almost transparent to anyone if you think about them
Stephen, if you'll hold those, that'd be terrific because we don't even have 30 seconds, and I don't want to let those go by lightly. We've got to take a short break here. Stephen Levitt is with us. He's professor of economics at the University of Chicago. He is co-author of Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. You can join us tonight. Do you feel a prisoner of opinion these days? And could tough numerical analysis of social problems give us answers where politicians give us polarization? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back with Stephen Levitt. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about myth-busting numbers, about economic analysis that cuts through ideology and presumption. My guest is the University of Chicago economist Stephen Levitt. His new book with Stephen Dubner is Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. You can join us tonight. Could it be that tough numerical analysis of social problems may give us answers where politicians and ideology do not? Are there truths, maybe even a third way, that ideology just cannot find? Are you ready to believe that legalizing abortion cut crime rates in America? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Stephen Levitt raising eyebrows and no little ruckus with some of these assertions, insights, I should say, analysis. But they really get your attention. Stephen Levitt, you were about to take us into a couple of the lines of analysis that brought you to this conclusion about abortion and falling crime rates. I mean, persuade us that this isn't just happenstance, that these things coincide.
Okay, let me start with the theory. So the theory couldn't be simpler. Unwanted children are at an elevated risk for crime and many other difficult life outcomes. I think it stands to reason we could all agree that, you know, if your parents don't want you and don't raise you in a loving environment, that puts you at a disadvantage. The second piece is that with the legalization of abortion, the number of unwanted children fell. I think that also stands to reason that the reason one will get an abortion is because a pregnancy is unwanted. You put those two pieces together, fewer unwanted children because of legalized abortion, unwanted children at risk for crime. That means that there should be, at least in theory, a link between the legalization of abortion and the reduction in crime.
Now, are you pushing the traditional economic bounds of cause and effect here, or is this within sort of, you know, what traditional economists would say? Yeah, this plus that equals a proof.
Well, from the theory, I think it's just hard to disagree with the theory. I mean, whether or not empirically it turns out to be of an important magnitude is another question. But let me give you another example of the theory. If we killed everyone, then there would be no crime. Okay, I think most people would agree with that statement.
There'd be one big crime, and then less.
Exactly. In some sense, it's a nuance. Well, what we're putting forth with as an explanation for legalized abortion is a nuanced view of that. Saying it's not that we're, you know, that there are a bunch of children we're never born who would have been here. Those children aren't just a random selection of children. They're a very special set of children who would have had very difficult life circumstances. And so the effect you get on crime might be indeed quite large. Now, theory, of course, means nothing without data to back it up. And really, the crux of our argument rests on the data. And there are a number of pieces of data which very clearly support the argument. So let me build from some of the weaker ones to the stronger ones. Now, the weakest one by far, but it's at least worth pointing out, is that the decline in crime in the United States began in about 1991, which is roughly 18 years after the legalization of abortion. That fits very nicely with the idea that children are reaching their peak years of crime around the age of 18. So that's consistent with the story, but in no way, no means should it really convince you that the answer. If you look at the set of states, there were five states that legalized abortion in 1970, 3 years prior to Roe versus Wade.
Ahead of the wave,
And those states indeed see crime begin to fall 3 years earlier than the other states, and they see property crimes, which are done by younger children, fall even sooner than they see violent crimes. So building now towards stronger and stronger arguments, there were real differences in the early 1970s in the availability of abortion across states. So even though it was
technically legal, but not so easily
Achieved. So in North Dakota, there were zero abortions, legal abortions performed in 1973 and 1974. You just couldn't find an abortion clinic. Mm. So what we do is we examine states. And for simplicity, let's just think of states that had really high, the highest rates of abortion, the average rates of abortion, and the lowest rates of abortion. If you track their crime trajectory for the next 15 years, those three states look essentially identical. There's no differences in the patterns of crime that they experience. It's only roughly 15 to 20 years later, which is exactly the time when you expect legalized abortion to start having an effect, you see a very strong divergence between these three sets of states. Indeed, you see in the high abortion states that crime falls by fully 30% over the next decade relative to the other states. And indeed, the states that had low abortion rates have seen almost no decline in crime, even in this period of incredible declines that we've seen in crime through the 1990s. And, the last argument you can make is that if you look just at the cohorts born exactly before and after the legalization of abortion, so we're comparing people who were born in 1972 to 1973 or 1974, and you see very abrupt breaks in the patterns of arrest for those cohorts in the same states who experienced almost the exact same sort of upbringing, same environment, but they were just separated by the legalization of abortion.
So you're getting to a finer and finer level of numerical analysis there. Does that leave you at the end as an economist with a moral leap to make? Do you make the leap? Or is it beyond economics to say then legal abortion is a good?
The thing that has to be kept clear is that the magnitude of the effect we're talking about in terms of reducing homicides, we're talking about a reduction of 3,000 or 4,000 homicides a year. It's really trivial relative to the background of the discussion we're having in this country about legalized abortion.
Because, opponents of abortion would say that each of those million abortions, you know, they put it in the homicide category.
Absolutely. So we're talking a million abortions for 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 homicides. To many, many people, they would say that's a terrible trade-off. Now, go to the other side of the debate. Many of the ardent supporters of legalized abortion are doing it not on utilitarian grounds, but on libertarian grounds, that a woman simply has a right to choose.
Matter
and just
principle.
As the freedom of speech exists, and even in cases where maybe we don't like the fact that someone is doing hate speech, we still let it go anyway because liberties supersede the utilitarian consideration. So really, it would be my own views on abortion have not been swayed by this study, and I think anyone whose views were swayed, I would actually say that it would be foolish on their part to be swayed. This is not a paper that tells you how you should feel about abortion. It maybe tells you how you should think about unwantedness. It maybe tells you how you should think about policies towards reducing crime, but it absolutely should not be convincing you to be pro or con when it comes to abortion.
But a close look that shows that policies have real implications. There's so much in here. I want to take a kind of a quick triple along the buffet. Here's your question. What do school teachers and sumo wrestlers have in common? That opens up a couple of stories all about incentives. Take us in there, Stephen Levitt.
Absolutely. So the thing that we find that school teachers in the Chicago schools and sumo wrestlers have in common is that in the right circumstances, they cheat. So just like just about anybody else, if you set up an incentive scheme that gives them rewards to cheat, some of them will take advantage of that and try to bend the rules.
Go to school teachers first. Few of us can relate to the cheating of sumo wrestlers, I imagine. School teachers we can picture. What's the case you make?
Well, so what the claim we make in this paper, this is joint work with Brian Jacob, who is at the Kennedy School of Government, and we are trying to look at how incentives affect how teachers behave. And so when we talk about teachers cheating, we don't mean teaching to the test or taking and giving the students a little extra time. We actually mean taking the forms, you know, the bubbles, the A, B, C, D, E forms that the students are filling out,
multiple
and actually
choice,
erasing
yeah.
those answers and filling in the correct ones.
That's what you'd call cheating.
And, yeah, so we're talking about very explicit kinds of cheating. And it may not be just teachers. It may be administrators. It may be principals as well.
So this is kind of unintended consequences. They're under pressure to produce schools with higher performing students. And the result is they simply went in Chicago and erased answers and put in their own. How on earth do you track that down? How do you know that's true?
Well, so in the Chicago schools, public schools, were incredibly accommodating, gave us the kind of data you would need to do that, which is every student's test score over a seven-year period. This is hundreds of thousands of students, millions of answers. And what we did was try to come up with algorithms, rule of thumb, to try and figure out what would be a signal to us that a teacher was cheating. So let me just give you the simplest example. One of the things that works best, it's very intuitive. Or let me give you two. The first one would be just blocks of identical answers within a classroom. So if all the students suddenly starting on question 30 in a classroom all start answering C, D, C, B, A, yeah. and those happen to be the right answers, that would be something that might be a dead giveaway that someone had gone in and interceded. Even a better giveaway is sometimes there'll be a lot of blank answers left by a handful of students, followed by a block of correct answers, followed by more blank answers, which is, you know, I think about as obvious as a teacher can get in manipulating the test scores, the test sheets. But even better, I think it turns out, is classrooms where the students are getting the easy questions wrong and the hard questions right. Empirically, that turns out to be the single best predictor we have for identifying who's cheating.
Now, and Chicago believed you. 12 school teachers lost their jobs.
Well, they did. The fund, not to put losing your jobs and fun in the same sentence. But the fun thing about this project for us is that usually academics toil in complete obscurity. No one cares about your results. You can't get anyone to do anything. But when Arnie Duncan, the head of the Chicago schools, heard about our findings, what was amazing to me was that instead of circling the wagons and saying we were foolish and wrong, he said, I don't want cheating in my school system. I want to get rid of these cheaters. And so he invited us in to audit, to retest a few weeks after the initial exam was given under controlled circumstances where the teachers wouldn't have access to the test forms. And we were able to pick out classrooms that a priori looked like they were cheating, compare those to classrooms that a priori looked like they were average or where the teachers were really effective teachers. And the results came back and they were incredibly supportive of what we were doing. It showed that the classrooms we suspected of cheating went from being some of the best classrooms in the system to being below average.
So what do you take away from this? With the sumo wrestlers, I don't suppose it's worth going into at all, except you point out that when they're in a circumstance that rewards throwing a match, matches get thrown. So what's the takeaway from your insight on incentives here?
Well, I think the takeaway is that, you know, we're all people. We're not necessarily good people or bad people, but you put us in the right or the wrong circumstances, we'll behave in good or bad ways. And I think it's, to an economist, it seems completely obvious that that if you really give people something worth cheating for, they're going to go ahead and do that. Even W.C. Fields was keenly aware of that in a quote he had many years ago where he said, anything worth winning is worth cheating for.
Take us into one more of your continents. How is the Ku Klux Klan like a group of real estate agents? That'll have everybody mad.
Yeah, so the last thing we need to do is set off the realtors even any more than I already have.
School teachers are already outside the door. Now the Klan and agents. What's that about?
So the idea is that it's the use and abuse of information was and is critical to the success of both the Klan and the realtors. And we tell a story in the Klan that is very interesting. It's about a man named Stetson Kennedy. He's an amazing American hero who infiltrated the Klan after World War II. The Klan was growing in power. They were burning crosses on Stone Mountain. And he infiltrated the Klan, and he did everything he could to try and bring it down through legal means, through the attorney general, through alerting union busters, and nothing was working until he had the great idea to call up the producers of the Superman radio show and to entice them to do a set of episodes in which Superman was fighting the Klan. Now, it turns out Superman really needed some enemies. He'd been fighting Hirohito and Hitler and Mussolini for so long, and they were gone. This is 1946, 47. They needed someone to fight. So Kennedy fed to the radio producers, all of the secret handshakes and information of the Klan.
The real nitty-gritty that people didn't know.
Yeah, so people didn't know anything about it. And what turned out is it was ridiculous. The things the Klan were doing were embarrassing and very childish. And in particular, what it did was it turned the children of the Klan members against their father. So one of the members of the Klan would go home. He'd find his kids playing, you know, the Superman and the Klan. And the good guy was the Superman, mm-hmm. who was beating the Klan guy over the head. And they began, you know, they were worried about, well, what's going to happen if my kids find my cape?
So what attracts my economist to this story, Stephen Levitt? What attracts you to this situation?
Well, I think it's all, again, it's information. There's really been a revolution in economics when it comes to the treatment of information and imperfect information. I'd say of the theoretical advances in the profession of the last 20 years, I think the appreciation of the role of information has been really at the top of that. And, partly it's just a great story. I just found it to be an amazing story about how creative uses of information can really be much more successful than kind of following the regular beaten path and filing lawsuits. You know, he found a great way to solve a problem, kind of like, you know, the Gordian knot. Instead of trying to untie it, he just cut right through it.
Exposing the data in a new way. And how does that then link into real estate agents?
So, to talk about realtors, I just need to review a little bit of background, which many people will be familiar with, mm-hmm. which is when you sell a house and you hire a realtor to be your agent, you typically pay about 6%. So of that 6%, 3% goes to the buyer's agent, 3% goes to the seller's agent, and then that 3% will be split again between the realtor and the realty company. So
right.
the agent, him or herself, takes home about 1.5% of the value of the house. So if you were able to sell your house for an extra $10,000 by, say, waiting 1 week, it would turn into $150 into the pocket of your real estate agent.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So bearing in mind that the real estate agent will do a lot of work showing the house, paying for ads, maybe doing an open house, in the end, although the home seller would really like to get that extra $10,000 for waiting a week or two, the realtor may think it's just not worth doing. And so as a consequence, a realtor who has much better information about the market and what a house is worth and whether or not there are a lot of buyers out there has a lot of power over the seller and will use that, or could use that, I should say, doesn't have to, but can use that information to their own advantage by telling their client to accept offers that they wouldn't accept themselves. I start with theory, but I think the proof is really in the data. So what we were able to do was assemble 100,000 home sales from suburban Chicago. And unlike other experts, I think many experts have the same feature. They have better information than the people they're serving, and they use it to their advantage. But the difference is that realtors, it's recorded in the public record whether or not a realtor owned the house, whereas you don't see surgeons do surgery on themselves, and
right.
you don't see the log of a car mechanic taking care of his own car.
So you can look at how they treat their own home.
Exactly. And so what we find is that when they sell their own home, they sell it for 3 to 4% more than comparable homes, trying to control for every other factor we can. But what really kind of seals the deal is the fact that they keep their houses on the market about 10% longer than their clients do, which suggests to me that they're waiting, holding out for that really good offer and telling their clients to sell too quickly.
So, again, the power of information. Is this creating models for policy? Is it creating models for other economists to take to other arenas? When you do each of these nuggets, we learn something about realtors and sumo wrestlers and even a few Chicago school teachers. But the larger takeaway goes where, Stephen Levitt?
Well, I think there are a couple applications you can take away from it. One is just the idea that incentives matter and that if you're creative, you can find the role of incentives in different places. But in terms of other applications, I've long said that I take these toy examples because there's a way to keep score. So with the sumo wrestlers, someone's keeping score of the match outcomes. With the teachers, you've got the answer sheets. And that what we would learn from these studies would help us try to answer deeper, more important questions, maybe questions about government corruption, maybe questions about terrorism. And indeed, I'm now getting my chance. Maybe I never really fully believed that I would get a chance, but I was just saying that to try and cover for the fact I was doing such trivial applications. But now I'm actually getting a chance working with a foreign bank has invited me to work with them to try to analyze their banking records in the hopes of finding the trail of terrorists through that.
And maybe one day American national policy, maybe national security, and something about protecting the country from terrorists. Stephen Levitt, stand by. We have to take a short break here. Stephen Levitt, economist at University of Chicago. His new book is Freakonomics. We're talking about myth-busting numbers, about economic analysis that cuts through ideology and presumption, through conventional wisdom. You can join us tonight. Could tough numerical analysis of social problems give us answers where politicians do not? What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about myth-busting numbers with economist Stephen Levitt. He joins us tonight from Chicago. He's an economist at the University of Chicago and co-author of the new book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. You can join the conversation tonight. Is it time to turn off the pundits and do the math, do the analysis? And what phenom would you like to see Stephen Levitt explore next, to take on next? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Mitch is calling from Boston. Hi, Mitch. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. I'm a big fan of Stephen Levitt. It's an honor to hear him and talk to him. I've been a fan of his since the paper on abortion and crime. I had a question that's a psychological question.
Yeah.
Maybe, but why is it that people are so resistant? I mean, people will get all excited about numbers when it comes to increasing sales or, you know, making more money, but they're so resistant to the truth of data, you know, truth of numbers and other aspects of life. So you mentioned ethical issues, and it's I've always found it puzzling that people don't make these connections. That, you know, they put math in one compartment, and then they have their sometimes very idealistic platonic notions in another compartment. Do you have any ideas about this resistance, or how people in general can become more literate?
It's a great question. Stick with us for a minute, Mitch. Stephen Levitt, how about it? Do you find, first of all, do you agree with Mitch that people are resistant to the truth of data?
Well, I do agree with Mitch. I think that's right. That in a lot of work environments, people are every day exposed to numbers and trying to increase sales, as he says. But when it comes to thinking about how we live our life, or parenting, or abortion, I think people are much more resistant. Now, let me defend the people who are resistant, and I think there's one good reason why that might be, which is that people with an agenda can manipulate numbers in much the same way they can manipulate words. And if you have less of an understanding of numbers and words, you may rightfully be more fearful of the distortions that people can do with numbers, with words. And whereas if you think about trying to increase sales, most of the people who are talking about increasing the sales are all on the same team. You know, it's not like one guy is trying to trick some other guy into something. So I think that could be one explanation why people are fearful of numbers in these other contexts.
Mitch, what about it? Statistics, damn statistics and lies. When lots of people don't have Stephen Levitt's skill at numerical analysis, is it reasonable for them then to revert to a kind of ideological argument in a democracy?
Well, I've never been a big fan of ideology, you know. I'm not sure it's also really a skill issue, although I'm curious if Stephen Levitt has any ideas about increasing this literacy, or any programs, or any ideas he might have about potential in that.
Let us pick it up. And Mitch, thanks for your call. Stephen Levitt, what about it? Are you going to bring the entire country around to a more numerical way of looking at social issues, policy debate?
Well, I doubt it, but I wouldn't mind. But I doubt I will ever have that kind of sway. I think a lot of it, if you read our book, the analysis is simple and trivial. It's asking the right question. It's thinking clearly about issues. And if you look at my work, I don't do anything sophisticated. Often my most compelling pictures are just comparisons of raw data. I mean, but a related issue, I mean, so where might you start? You might start with politicians listening to numbers. But my experience is that although I've often been contacted by politicians because of mm-hmm. some research I've done in certain mm-hmm. areas, I have never once, as far as I know, changed a politician's mind on an issue. That I've found I'm only called when the politician already has decided what they're in favor of, and they go looking for an academic to support.
He wants affirmation from you. Does that leave you despondent? You know, you're off with, as you say, your toy examples, but they don't get played out in real policy.
Well, I just think it's a reality, and anyone who goes into academics because they think that their great idea will change the world is probably going for the wrong reasons. I think the right reason to go into academics is because you get to explore absolutely any question you want. You have the freedom to do what you want. It's fun, and it's exciting intellectually. And it's very, very hard to change behavior. And politicians mm-hmm. don't understand numbers themselves. And it's an uphill battle. I mean, I think you can only hope that you're a very small bit player in trying to make a world a tiny bit better place.
And yet you've got us all thinking tonight. John is calling from New York City. Hi, John, you're on the air.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Great, thanks.
I think a lot of the public resistance that people have to this sort of stuff regarding social policy is that Stephen is kind of basing his assumption on that he has the totality of information available to him. And, you know, like on the crime issue,
yes.
For the past few years, I've had a pet theory, and I'm not an economist, but I've wondered if the precipitous drop in crime rate has really been the result of the fact that crime doesn't pay anymore.
Why wouldn't it pay?
Because there are cash machines at every corner now, and the home electronics are virtually worthless.
I get the home electronics part. You can't sell that CD player for much, but the cash machine, what's the...
No one ever carries more than $100
on
it just doesn't pay to mug anyone.
So intuitively, you look at these two things and say, maybe these are bigger than Stephen Levitt's abortion explanation.
I mean, you work on this assumption that criminals don't operate with, you know, broad economics in mind, but, you know, there was a time when you could steal a stereo or a car stereo. When was the last time you know someone who had their car stereo stolen? When was the last time you know someone who had their house broken into and their TV or their VCR stolen?
Well, it certainly happens, but maybe not the same windfall for the thief. Stephen Levitt, what about it? John saying, what's your claim on the totality of, I don't know, causality here?
Well, John, if you're not an economist, you think like an economist. That's great. So Gary Becker wrote the seminal piece on crime, The Economics of Crime, in 1968. And his theory was really what you just said, which is that criminals act like anybody else, rationally weighing the cost and the benefits of doing crimes. And while I think that theory has limitations, many criminal acts are not done in rational, you know, there's a lot of irrationality, you know, the effect of drugs and alcohol can intercede. But I totally agree with you. So don't get me wrong. I'm not saying that the only reason crime went down was legalized abortion. I'm just saying it turned out to be one of the most important. I mean, other factors that are very related to the costs and benefits of crime are, for instance, the increase in the number of police and also the number of prisons. We've gone from having 200,000 prisoners in the mid-1970s to 2 million prisoners in the current time, and that is an incredible increase in the costs of doing crime. Now, so let's take your point and let's explore it further. So you're giving a theory for why people aren't breaking into cars and why people might not be doing street muggings. Mm. What's harder to explain in light of your theory would be, for instance, why the number of auto thefts have gone down so much, right? Because cars mm-hmm. are worth as much or more as they ever were.
Sure.
Or the number of rapes or the number of homicides, many homicides being done not for financial reasons, mm-hmm. but rather because of, you know, just arguments and whatnot. And all of those crimes have fallen across the board, really no more, no less than burglary or robbery. But I love the way you're thinking. I think that's exactly the way people should think. And let me be the first to say that the last thing I would want someone to do would be to take my arguments and acquiesce. I mean, that's the whole spirit of my research and of this book, is that it's supposed to get you thinking. And you may not agree with everything, And I love the fact that people will challenge it, especially when the challenge comes, as you just put, with a really thoughtful, kind of testable argument rather than just an ideological backlash.
John, in New York, sounds like maybe time for that economics degree. Maybe you've got it already.
No, I don't. No.
Well, keep
I don't know that it pays.
Well, Stephen Levitt's doing all right right now.
Well, he's one man.
Yeah, he is. John, thanks very much for your call. Stephen, you've got us on the subject of crime, and you've got another big question that you put up, one of these provocative questions. Why do drug dealers still live with their moms? Why do you ask it, and what do you find?
Well, first, let me tell you what we find. We find they live at home because they don't make any money, that being a drug dealer, a street-level drug dealer, is actually a terrible job and, quite honestly, might be the single worst job you could possibly have in America. The pay is terrible, and the risks are incredible. The way we address this question is I'm just incredibly fortunate. I hooked up with a researcher named Sudhir Venkatesh, a fantastic sociologist, an ethnographer who had spent 6 or 7 years in with the gang, and he earned the gang's trust to such a degree that they handed over their financial records to us, the books, the accounting that they were doing. We were able to, combining his ethnographic research, his day-to-day observations with the financial data, the numbers, come up with these insights that no one has ever had.
And they kept books, a kind of profit and loss statement?
They did. These weren't, you know, Ernst & Young accredited kind of books, but they were pretty good. You know, they had the cost they were paying, which were buying the powder cocaine, the wages they were paying out. They had to pay a tremendous amount of tribute to the central gang. And really what the gang – and then on the revenue side, you had the revenues from selling the crack cocaine, from extortion, from dues. And we were able to follow them over a period of years in which there would be gang wars at certain times. They actually had a hostile takeover of another neighboring gang. And a number of really interesting insights come out of this paper. One was just that the low-level guys make almost no money, something like $5 an hour, $3.50 an hour, depending on the time period.
So they have to live with their moms.
Exactly. And the guys at the top make an enormous amount. So it really overwhelmingly what you come away with is that this gang looks like corporate America. The guys at the top are doing great. The guys at the bottom are making minimum wage. And even the structure of the game, it really, if you just look at the organizational chart for this gang, you can't tell it apart from McDonald's. It was operated as a franchise business with local leaders running the franchises. And it's really, for me, maybe the most interesting and fascinating project for me about how much I learned about how the economy works from the study.
And here you say through this you look at conventional wisdom and you find it to be a web of fabrication, self-interest, and convenience. What's the fabrication? What's the conventional wisdom's misapprehension in this case?
Well, I think I don't know if it was police departments, politicians who were pushing the war on drugs, maybe the drug dealers themselves, but there was this concerted effort, I believe, in the media to portray drug dealers as being rich, wearing gold chains, driving fancy cars. And now that's true. So there are 15 guys out of this gang of 20,000 who are living that kind of lifestyle. But I think anyone who spent time in the inner city knows that the street level drug dealers are not exactly thriving. And
you got the numbers to prove it. Our time's growing short. I want to get to your take on parents and parenting. You ask what makes a perfect parent, and you come up with a rather different answer than I think most people would expect. Give us a sense of that.
Yes, this is work with Roland Fryer, who actually was on your show about a month ago.
Yeah, terrific guy at Harvard now.
Exactly. We used a data set called the Early Childhood Longitudinal Study of 20,000 kids, tracking them from early in their life until the third grade. And what we find is that many of the characteristics that we typically associate with the parenting style, so things like spanking or reading to your children or taking them to museums, when you try to correlate those behaviors with test scores of children in kindergarten or third grade, you find no relationship whatsoever. So what parents do
thousands of frazzled parents are collapsing right now saying, what, after all that work? You're kidding.
Yeah, so throw the baby Mozart tapes in the garbage and focus on something else. Now, it's not that we don't find that parents matter. It's just because there are strong relationships between certain characteristics of parents and how their children do. But it's not how they spend their time with their kids. It's the characteristics of the parents. So older parents who held off on childbearing for longer tend to have children with better outcomes. Higher education parents have better outcomes. Even, interestingly, houses that have homes that have a lot of children's books in them, the children do better. Now, you might say, wait, how is that possible? If the reading to the children doesn't do any good, how can having the books in the home? And I think it's really that books in a home are a statement about the kind of environment that the child is living in. And it says that the parents are caring about the children, that they're focused on the children. And one little piece of evidence, I don't have time to really go well into the evidence here, is that having books in the home is as strongly correlated with how the students do on math as they do on reading.
But this is kind of a depressing analysis. I mean, if you don't start, if you're a young parent instead of an older parent, if you're not a highly educated parent, if you don't have a lot of books but you're willing to put in the elbow grease, you're saying, too bad, it doesn't work, just by the effort you put into your child rearing. It's counterintuitive.
Well, you know, it may be the kind of effort. So I should make 2 points. One is that there's enormous variation. So, you know, the parents who on paper look like their children should do best off and their kids don't, and the parents who are really struggling in bad situations, sometimes they have fantastic children in spite of their difficulties. So that's an important point to make. Well, the other point is that I think it really goes back in a roundabout way to the work that I did on legalized abortion, which is that the single most important thing a parent can do for their child is to make them feel loved and wanted. That would be my take on it. That's, I think, what the research suggests. And so it doesn't take money necessarily or museums or fancy clothes. I think, you know, my own view, and this is maybe just a hypothesis, not really any data for it, is that I think with the parent treating the child the right way, a trip to the grocery store can be just as enlightening as a trip to the museum. It's just, it depends on how you interact with your children, not so much the things that you particularly do.
So you've got all these examples. You call them toy examples, but when it comes to parenting, they don't look so small anymore. People invest monumental amounts of energy and hope and anxiety in that. When you add them all up, do you see a lesson that you're hoping will leap to a public policy arena? Do you look out of the country and say, my gosh, we're so awash in conventional wisdom, presumption, ideology, we're not dealing with what's really going on?
Well, I don't know that. I think we're doing pretty well as a country all in all. I mean, I'm not one of these negative naysayers, but I do think that there's room in public policy debates for trying to find a middle ground. People who don't have a strong ideology but are motivated by numbers and data. And, you know, but to be honest, I don't really do this because I think I'm going to affect public policy. I just do it because it's fun. I just love to do it. There's nothing else I'd rather be doing. And if as a byproduct somebody gets help, that's great too.
There goes the rogue economist out on the high frontier. Why do you call it freakonomics? It doesn't sound so freaky.
Well, you know, we just wanted to have some fun. I mean, this is supposed to be a fun book, and economics is a dismal science. Everyone thinks that economists are boring and don't travel in interesting questions. And so we just wanted to send the strongest possible signal to people who would read this book that we were out to have fun and we were out to challenge things. And it's a mischievous book, and almost anyone who reads it, I think, will be upset about some parts of it and hopefully laugh out loud at other parts and hopefully leave the whole experience at least somewhat the better for it.
Lots of great head turners here. Stephen Levitt, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
Stephen Levitt, professor of economics at the University of Chicago and author of the new book, Freakonomics, A Rogue Economist Explores the Hidden Side of Everything. Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Chris O'Connor, John Roberts, James Ross, and Karen Schiffman, with help from George Hicks, Cora Peterson, and Angel Cozzelli. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.